Again, going through our series on the Iberian crypto Jews, we're up to the fifth of six today of the talks I'll be doing, and it's mainly about the modern history of these people, the Jews and the crypto Jews in Latin America and in Spain and Portugal. So before we go into it, though, I'll make a quick note on the Torah portion. So this week it's a double portion, Acharei Matzah Kedoshim. Then these two portions in Leviticus are normally read together. So it's quite a few readings. It's essentially four chapters of, actually five chapters essentially of Leviticus, also a portion from Ezekiel, as you can see, and the book of Matthew as well, for us Messianic Jews as well. And just a quick summary of the portion today. In a nutshell, it contains the death of Aaron's sons for giving the forbidden sacrifice, and there's warnings about approaching the presence of God when we are not called for, when God does not demand our sacrifice, does not demand our worship. And also a related warning about not offering sacrifices anywhere other than the place God will choose. So that's a re they're all related themes related to respecting the presence of God and not approaching when not called. Also various laws regarding lots of different topics regarding the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, as we know in Hebrew, regarding the dietary laws, kashrut, so in particular not eating blood. The commandment to drain the blood is from this portion. And also laws regarding sexual relations. In fact, the discussions about homosexuality in the Old Testament is in this portion. Also other aspects of life, so charity, honesty, sexual morality in general, and honoring your parents are just some of the examples. And the New Testament teaching today from Matthew relates Yeshua's teaching regarding what comes out of a person being more important as what goes in. So it's sort of talking about I guess being a pure moral person is mostly determined by the things that come out. So actually, it's quite related to what the Leviticus portion talks about, because the aspects of sort of sanctity that we're called to have in Leviticus are sort of the opposite things which can come out of a person, which can defile a person. So very much related. But anyway, getting back onto our topic today, which is the continued discussion on the story of the Sfaradim and the crypto Jews. I'll just quickly recap where we've gone so far, because we have gone quite a bit of a journey. So our first week, we reviewed the possibilities of the origins of the Sfaradim, so where they came from. Our second week, we reviewed the Golden Age, when they were at the most successful in Spain and Portugal. Our third week, we reviewed the decline of the Sfaradim until their expulsion from Spain in 1492. Last week, we started talking about the story of the crypto Jews up until about the 18th century in both Iberia, so Spain and Portugal, and also in Latin America. And this week, we'll quickly review modern Jewish and crypto Jewish history in these places. Now, I say Jewish and crypto Jewish because after the 18th and 19th centuries, Jews from other parts of the world started to settle in these countries, and they have had a massive influence on the history of these countries. So I will continue to talk about both of them today. And just a side note here, again, I have included a couple of references today, breaking with that rule, but generally I will not be giving references with the presentations, but I will be with the written accounts, which I will make available. So now let's continue where we left off. So crypto Judaism in the 18th century. So look, it wasn't a pretty sight in those days. Like in most places, it was either essentially dead or heavily suppressed and underground. The Golden Ages, in quotation marks, the Golden Ages of crypto Judaism in Mexico was certainly diminished. Was mainly individuals and small families in isolated areas. So it wasn't really any major organized institution. It was highly syncretic, which means there was a combination of Jewish and Christian belief and practice, and mostly vestigial customs. So what I mean by vestigial customs? So these are customs which have remained, so they will continue to be practiced, but they lost their original meaning. So for example, lots of crypto Jewish families and new Christian families, they lit Shabbat candles, or they lit candles on Friday night, but oftentimes the meaning has been lost over time. So they would sort of understand this as like a family tradition, candles on this day, for example, or like just something that the family did, but without understanding the original meaning to hallow the Shabbat. And that actually happened quite a lot, including actually people that I know personally. And unfortunately, or I guess, look, unfortunately from our point of view, new Christians started to mostly resemble old Christians in terms of belief, in terms of practice. they're mostly assimilated into society, and the incorporation of the various Christian beliefs into the dogma, even though they try to you know, consciously reject it, it was starting to really be ingrained into their psyche after so many decades and now centuries of sort of pressure and intimidation by the church, the Catholic Church. However, there was hope on the way, and it came in the sort of form of the Enlightenment. Now, the Enlightenment was essentially a movement of liberal thinking in Western Europe towards the end of the 18th century. There were a few key proponents of that, and it greatly influenced the Iberian leadership to grant emancipation to minorities, to give citizens more personal freedom and more rights and more representation in government. So, for example, there were monarchies, which were essentially absolute monarchies, that they didn't give any of their power to the people. After this movement, there were still monarchies, but they sort of gave, they developed what's called a constitutional monarchy, which essentially means the king or queen is still the head of the state, but there is some power which is given to a parliament through a constitution, which means that people can have more decision-making power as well as the monarchy, even though the monarchy still has the final say. And perhaps the Iberian leadership was feeling embarrassed because the Inquisitions were quite cruel. And even for those days, many of the other Western European powers moved on. And Iberia was still very much behind in terms of its methods and its cruelty in carrying out those methods. And, you know, we might think, you know, who cares if a government's embarrassed, what's the power of embarrassment? So I wouldn't underestimate that. So many of us are too young to know this, but I've done a bit of research about the White Australia policy. And the White Australia policy was essentially a policy of selective admission to Australia, with mainly white people allowed than Europeans. And that actually prevented people like, you know, Africans and Middle Easterners and Asians from immigrating to Australia until the 70s, really. And much of the reason for the eventual sort of abolition of this policy was, or a series of policies, was obviously Australia was changing, people didn't tolerate it anymore, but a big part of it was also embarrassment to the world, in particular embarrassment in terms of Asian countries who we were actually trying to make, you know, to create diplomatic relations with, but we wouldn't let the citizens live here. So it was actually quite embarrassing to the governments in those days. That was a big part of the dismantling. In a similar way, the European powers were moving on. The Iberian monarchies were being left behind, and it was quite embarrassing for them. So they started to sort of reduce the persecution to the new Christians. We'll move on to the next slide. And the first place where this really happened was Portugal. So Portugal was probably the first to liberalize in the Spanish and Portuguese sphere. By 1768, new Christians were no longer monitored. So they used to have lists of new Christians which they would keep a close eye on for signs of heresy, but they stopped doing that in 1768. The Inquisition officially ended by 1821, but even towards the end of the 18th century, towards 1780, 1790, there were very few trials for Judaizing. There were mostly trials for other things, but not for crypto-Judaism. By this time, most, but not all, so I'll come back to this later on, not all, but most new Christians were assimilated into society. However, Jews from other places started trickling into Portugal throughout the 19th century, mostly from Morocco initially and also from Britain, but also from other places slowly. Especially during the 20th century, Portugal played a key role in sheltering Ashkenazi Jews during the Holocaust as well. Today, though, there was only about 1,000 affiliated Jews in Portugal, mostly around the capital, Lisbon. The reason why there's so few, I think there's a few reasons. I think Portugal didn't officially recognize the Jewish community until 1892. That was part of it. And I think, I don't think it was particularly friendly to Jews even throughout the 20th century until maybe the late 20th century. So not many Jews actually returned to Portugal after all this has happened. Now, Spain was even worse. Crypto-Judaism was essentially completely suppressed in Spain. Officially, the Inquisition ended there in 1834. From about 1868, the constitutional monarchy allowed Jews to practice Judaism privately in their own homes, but not publicly. So Judaism was actually still technically illegal in Spain, even after this, and it was not officially allowed again until 1968, when the Alhambra Decree was finally rescinded. So remember, the Alhambra Decree was the one which after 1492, it forbade Jews from practicing Judaism. So that was not officially removed until 1968. Imagine that, like almost 400 years of this really terrible decree. Despite this, Spain did harbour Ashkenazi Jews during the Holocaust, and they did shelter them. So a bit of an irony here, but they did do that. Today, I mean, we're not really sure how many Jews exactly live in Spain because not all of them are affiliated, but between 13,000 and 50,000 Jews today. Again, mostly from the last few decades, and a far cry from the amount of Jews that lived in Spain before 1492. I'll make a quick note here. From 2015, the Spanish and Portuguese governments had a very interesting policy of allowing people descended from those who were expelled to return or to apply for citizenship. So it's sort of a symbolic gesture to say sorry, or to acknowledge regret for expelling these people in the first place. So essentially, I think it's closed now, closed last year, I think, but essentially if you could prove that you were descended from someone who was expelled, again, very difficult to do in practice, then you could have Spanish or Portuguese citizenship. And many people actually apply for that, and it was, greatly appreciated by the Jewish community around the world, even though very few of these people actually moved to Spain and Portugal. So now we'll move on to Latin America. In Latin America, Jews have definitely left a far more significant mark. Argentina is probably the most significant one. I will highlight the four key Jewish communities in Latin America today, which is Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, and Chile. In Argentina, not many crypto-Jews actually ever made it there. However, towards the end of the 19th century, huge amounts, thousands of Ashkenazi Jews from Poland, from Lithuania, Russia, they fled to Argentina. So it was very interesting. By 1920, there were already 150,000 Jews in Argentina. It was a massive wave of immigration. At its peak, 13,000 Jews a year made it to Argentina from Eastern Europe. And the reason why so many Jews went to Argentina was similar to the reasons why so many Jews went to America. For the sort of end of the 19th century, start of the 20th century, Argentina was one of the richest countries on earth. It was seen as a place of opportunity, a place of freedom where people can essentially build new lives in peace. And obviously, these Ashkenazi Jews were fleeing terrible circumstances in Europe. So it was seen as a place of hope for these people. So they fled there in large numbers. However, since the mid-20th century, there were many challenges for the community, and also these challenges are very similar across the whole country. It became a safe haven for Nazis. Unfortunately, one of the presidents during the middle of the century, his name is Juan Domingo Perón, he was a well-known Nazi sympathizer, so lots of ex-Nazis actually moved to Argentina. Of course, apart from that, there was the worsening economic and political situation, lots of extreme governments who mismanaged the economy, so increasing poverty in the country, increasing violence, increasing instability, increasing anti-Semitism as well. Multiple violent terrorist attacks have occurred in Jewish institutions in Argentina since the mid-20th century. Despite all that, it's still the largest community in Latin America with about 200,000 affiliated Jews today. And if we include Jews with recent Jewish ancestry, for example, a Jewish parent or grandparent, we can say roughly 500,000 Jews today. I'll move on to Brazil. Brazil also had quite a similar story in terms of the modern era. We have talked about the crypto-Jewish movement in Brazil last week, but essentially by the end of the 18th century, it was pretty much suppressed, except for a few communities in the interior of the country, which we'll talk about soon. But throughout the 19th century, Ashkenazi Jews fled to cities on the coast, such as Rio, such as Recife as well. But many Moroccan Jews, funny enough, went into the interior of the country as well. I'm sure that we were interested with the crypto Jews there. And in the 20th century, there was mixed Sephardi, mixed Ashkenazi immigration. Also, German Jews fled there to escape Hitler in the 1930s, but there were also a couple of anti-Semitic governments who stopped further immigration during the war. However, overall, the community in Brazil has been quite successful and quite peaceful and enjoy quite good conditions today. So I think roughly about 120,000 Jews live there today, affiliated Jews. Doesn't include the crypto Jews, of course, in the interior, and it has been a hotbed of crypto Jewish activity today, which I will talk about towards the end. Now, Mexico was probably the third largest community. The Inquisition there ended in about 1820. Very few openly practicing Jews actually came to light in Mexico throughout the rest of the 19th century. There were some Ashkenazi Jews from Russia who came towards the end of the 19th century, and the earlier 20th century saw Jews from the Ottoman Empire, so places like Turkey and Greece, Lebanon, places like that. They came to Mexico as well. Ashkenazi Jews, some of them were actually trying to go to America, but ended up staying in Mexico. In those days, Mexico was also quite prosperous, so it wasn't it wasn't seen as a bad consolation prize in those days. Of course, in recent decades, there've been problems with, you know, throughout the whole country, you know, drug related crime, with violence, with political instability, but still about 50,000 Jews who are affiliated live there today. And it's also been a hotbed for crypto Jewish revival as well, which I'll talk about towards the end. Now, Chile is definitely a distant fourth on the list. After you go past the first three, you really start to see much smaller communities. However, there are significant communities throughout the rest of Latin America as well. Colombia, Peru, among other countries, have significant communities as well. But Chile is probably the largest of the others. Not many crypto Jews also made it to Chile as well, but there were some new Christian conquistadors, so people who conquered lands from the native people. Probably some of them came from Peru who were new Christians, perhaps. There was a pattern of mixed immigration, Sephardi and Ashkenazi, in the late 19th and early 20th century. The main reason I wanted to mention Chile, there was actually a Chilean diplomat called Samuel del Campo, who was stationed in Romania as the Chilean representative in Romania at the embassy. And he actually used his position to save about 1,200 Jews during the Holocaust. He gave them all fake passports to essentially grant them immunity from deportation. So if you had a foreign passport in those days, like a non-European passport, it sort of saved you from deportation. So he was honored as a righteous among the nations as well for his really brave work, because his government didn't agree with him at the time. It wasn't something that he had permission to do. So we thank him for that. And today about 18,000 Jews live in Chile today, mostly around the capital, Santiago. So I'm going to now talk about, for the remainder of the talk today, about very, very briefly, again, I'm summarizing this very heavily, the crypto Jewish revivals. Now, I call them revivals because it's more about people coming into the open. These people never actually left the scene. It's more that, you know, they're more open today. So a bit about Brazil. We left off last time in terms of crypto Jews in 1654, where the Dutch, who initially conquered part of Brazil, who gave the Jews some freedom, they were kicked out. And most remaining crypto Jews eventually assimilated into the wider community. However, some of them went into the interior of the country in the Amazonian areas where it's easier to hide, so usually in small villages. There was no official persecution of these people in the 19th and 20th century. Now, I say official because they did have social persecution. They were definitely socially ostracized because these Jews were not actually that well hidden. Like, a lot of the villagers knew that they were descended from Jews, and they were ostracized as a result. And the reason, I'll give you an example. I read a blog on the internet about a crypto Jew who was growing up in the mid-20th century. So not that long ago, in a village in northeast Brazil. And the Catholic, according to this gentleman, the Catholic priest in the town actually asked the milkman not to give milk to the family. And the reason that he gave was because they were Jews. So he didn't want the Jews to be treated the same way as the non-Jews were. And there was a bit of social persecution there. So it continued right up to the mid-20th century in some of these towns. However, mainly from the late 20th century, from the 1990s, it's been much more open for them. The communities have felt much more safe. And they've sort of been able to come out into the open. And most of the time, they're really looking to make contact with other Jews. They're sort of coming out with the stories of preserved crypto Judaism, wishing to make contact with other Jews in Brazil, but also the world. And it's been an interesting situation. So reactions have been mixed. So because, look, there's obviously been support from some factions, but also criticism from other factions. So from their fellow Brazilians, who some of them also descend from crypto Jews as well, there is, of course, support for knowing about your past, unearthing your heritage. But most of them are content in the Catholic faith, which is the dominant faith in Brazil. And most of them don't want to rock the boat. So otherwise, they don't want to be pressured or compelled to change in any significant way. Fair enough in some ways. From the Jewish perspective, there has been a lot of support and a lot of influence trying to help these crypto Jews convert to normative Judaism. However, a lot of these people don't want to actually convert, mainly because they sort of have different, you know, a different faith system which incorporates elements of Christianity and Judaism. And as a result, a vast majority of the Jewish community actually rejects these people as being fully Jewish for that result. They don't want to officially convert, and they have demanded that from them. It's a complicated situation, which I won't get into, but it's been a complicated ride for these people. In Mexico, it's an interesting story because despite all the persecution, crypto Judaism never really went away exactly. It was heavily suppressed for a while, but people transmitted the knowledge pretty successfully between the generations. And since much of the territory of Mexico was actually conquered by America in the 19th century, so for example, Texas and Arizona, those sort of places were actually part of Mexico initially, where a lot of the crypto Jews actually settled, but then America conquered them. In the 19th century, in America, there was a much more free place than Mexico for Jews. So that actually helped them continue to keep their heritage alive. And communities today in northern Mexico and southern United States practice a complex mix of crypto-Jewish practices, and many more have been encouraged to come out into the open. DNA testing, as well as certain teachers, have encouraged this as well. They're actually quite large networks today. Probably thousands of people are actually quite connected with their we'll call it crypto Jewish heritage, and are trying to find out more. I will talk about some of the reactions to this towards the end because it is an important topic, and I think it's a topic that has been needs to be dealt with in a faith-centered way as well. Now, I will probably the most spectacular example of crypto Jewish revival has been in Belmonte. So Belmonte is a village of 6,000 people today in northeast Portugal. There was a Polish engineer by the name of Samuel Schwartz who made contacts with these people in 1917, and it was sort of a lost tribe experience. Like these Jews were very isolated, or crypto Jews were isolated. They had kept themselves isolated on purpose, and they didn't actually believe Samuel Schwartz was Jewish, and they were actually afraid of him because they were worried about getting sort of in trouble and being persecuted. But what he actually did was he said the Shema prayer to them, and because he said the Shema prayer, they started to believe him. And he started to spend some time with them. He spent quite some time with these people. He was working in a nearby mine as an engineer, and they were able to trace their heritage to 1297. There was a plaque that they had from 1297, the community kept, which was the beginning of their community. And they survived with careful secrecy and, unfortunately, a degree of endogamy as well, marrying within the group, a very small group. Apparently, they celebrated three festivals a year. That was all they were able to keep. The Passover, the fast of Esther, which is part of Purim, and also Yom Kippur, mainly the fast of Yom Kippur, as well as Shabbat and some aspects of kosher. So interesting that they kept those practices as well. Of course, with a large amount of syncretism as well. Now, there were a huge sensation in the Jewish world, actually. Initially, there were various Jewish communities who wanted to help these people reintegrate into the general Jewish community. Initially, these Jews wanted to just keep to themselves. They wanted to remain isolated, and they actually pushed back against attempts to integrate them, which is, I guess, understandable because they were fearful of the outside world. It was difficult for them to sort of come out of the closet after centuries of hiding. However, since the 1970s, they have been more open. They have actually asked people to come and to help them build a synagogue, to help them even convert some of those people to normative Judaism. So today, the community is about 300 people, give or take. They have a rabbi, they have a synagogue, they have a kosher market, and actually a museum, and they actually attract significant Jewish support around the world. Some in the community have embraced this and converted to Orthodox Judaism. However, the majority have not. And I think the reason why is the majority have gotten so used to the isolation, so used to the way they do things. And also, they've also suffered a bit of ridicule, a bit of sort of. Like there's been an aspect of being second class, not true Jews from the Jewish community around the world. They've actually, I think, as a result of retreated back into their isolation, unfortunately. So it's a bit of, again, a bit of a mixed bag. Now I'll talk briefly about DNA evidence because DNA evidence is amazing, but it's also very fickle as well. So there are a couple of studies here which I'm going to talk about, which have actually included the links at the end of the slides because I do think they're very important studies, excuse me. And there was a study in 2015 of the Belmonte Jews, the crypto Jews there, and they studied the DNA sequences. So it's very simple. You can do this today if you have the money and the time. A cheek swab, look at a few cells, and you sort of look at the DNA sequences, and you compare the DNA sequences with other Jewish groups, the particular Sephardic Jews. What they found was that not only that the Belmonte crypto Jews have most DNA in common with the Sephardic Jews in general, but also they had less admixture with Europeans than other Sephardim. So what that means is, of course, with Jewish groups around the world, you have a degree of intermarriage with the surrounding ethnic groups. The Belmonte Jews, because I think because they had so they practiced so much endogamy, they actually had less admixture than other Sephardim. So in some ways, they had more Jewish DNA according to this study. Very interesting study. And another study, a bigger study in 2017, this one in Latin America, showed that perhaps almost 25% of Latin Americans had significant Jewish ancestry. So they defined Jewish ancestry as greater than 5% of DNA sequences. So that's like obviously a game changer. Many people who suspected Jewish roots or are you actually using DNA to support or validate their tales, even if they have largely unfounded evidence otherwise, they're using the DNA to sort of prove their claim. So the question I've got here, if we actually take the results of that study and apply it, it was a large study, it was 7,000 people, so it wasn't a small study. If we apply this to the Latin American population, you would actually get 150 million people who are defined as having significant Jewish ancestry by the definition of the study, which essentially means more than 5%. Now, the question is, are there 150 million Jews in Latin America? Well, the answer is, of course, not. Remember, Jewish identity is complex. I'm going to go through my reasons now. Having 5%, so essentially the way the study defined having DNA, Jewish DNA, was having more than 5% DNA. And having more than 5% DNA is not really that convincing, to be honest. It's essentially saying you have one ancestor in the last 20 generations, so that's 5%, which roughly equates to the last 500 years if the average age of childbirth was about 25 years old. And as we all know, Jewish identity incorporates far more than just ethnicity, far more than race. It includes faith, it includes practice, culture, social constructs. That's probably the most important one, the social constructs. Most of these people do not identify themselves as Jews even, or with Judaism. So I'll give an example. So for example, the English colonized many different areas of Africa. One of the old English colonies was Nigeria. And many Englishmen married they had children with Nigerian women. So if someone who's descended from these people, descended from a couple hundred years later, has 5 or 10% Nigerian ancestry because of this, would that person call themselves Nigerian or will they call themselves English? Well, I'm sure if they live in England, they'll call themselves English. If they live in Nigeria, they'll call themselves Nigerian. And I think the reason for that is what your DNA has is it does not necessarily define your identity. There's so much more complexity to that. And just saying you have one ancestor who's Nigerian doesn't necessarily make a person Nigerian by any other metric. So in the same way, having one ancestor who's Jewish in the last 500 years doesn't necessarily make someone Jewish if we're actually using consistent logic, if that makes sense. Now, what this does show is that it does show the significant presence of Jews in Latin America despite the Inquisition. So it does show that many Jews actually made it to Latin America despite all the persecution, and they managed to survive there in significant numbers. That it does show that. So it really is a really profound study in terms of understanding the impact of Jews in Latin America, but it doesn't mean there's 150 million Jews. I think that's a bit ridiculous. And on this topic, I want to actually talk about handling this information in a healthy way. So first of all, I do want to stress it's only the minority of people who have actually looked into this. So most people who would qualify under this study for having Jewish ancestry, most of them have not really delved into this in any meaningful way. Only a very small minority have. On one level, this can be seen as adding great depth to a believer and great grounding for life. Of course, understanding one's heritage, understanding where one comes from can help add great meaning to life, can sort of bring their family traditions full circle, can help establish new connections. And, all believers, Ben Mashiach encourages all believers to understand the Jewish roots of their faith, which is the shared spiritual heritage for all believers. So there is a very healthy aspect to this. However, I also think it also can be very harmful. So also reading, some of the blogs and some of the testimonies, some of this has actually been very harmful. And it's interesting how when these people sort of frame these blogs, they actually try and frame it in a very positive way. But actually, if you read between the lines, you actually can see quite a few negative aspects to this. So I want to make a note, just from a psychological point of view, adults, so people who already had their brains fully mature, they have far more difficulty adjusting to information, adjusting to paradigm shifts than children do. So oftentimes adults adjust to these sort of things very badly. Some of this has actually promoted cultish behavior, I'm sure some of you have heard of the British Israelite movement, of course, not directly related to this, but essentially, like, you know, some of these groups have said, we are the true Jews, we are the ones who have survived until this day. Again, not the majority, everybody, but some people have sort of gone this way, or saying we are the only true believers, we are the only true something, we are special, everyone else is wrong. That's sort of, of course, very cultish behavior, and that has come out of this surge of revival as well. And sometimes this creates a lot of pain and division amongst families, between those who want to find out more about the Jewish beliefs and Jewish heritage, and the rest of the family who doesn't. There's lots of splits between families, unfortunately, because, of course, most people don't really want to rock the boat, but, of course, there's maybe one or two who do, and that can cause lots of division and split and pain. And perhaps, you know, is it really worth it if it's going to cause that much pain? Who knows? Of course, the mental health issues as a result, so personal confusion about identity. So because it's such a huge paradigm shift for these people, the sense of who they are and where they belong is shaken, and that can be really damaging to mental health as well, leading to depression, anxiety, things like that. And also the most important point that I have here, it has led, unfortunately, to many born-again, spirit-filled believers becoming angry at the church for some sort of, you know, for feeling that the church has taken away their Jewish heritage or things like that, and therefore, as a result, abandoning their faith. Not necessarily just to convert to Judaism, mind you, but also sometimes abandoning faith altogether. Like, I read testimonies where they were raised Catholic or raised as an evangelical Christian even, and then because they've found this out, they've actually just turned their back on all faith altogether, which is really a terrible, you know, a terrible situation. Even though the initial conversion may have been pressured, still, I still think these people, if they have a life-giving faith today and they're abandoning it because of what happened 500 years ago, I do think that's a great shame. So I put this here in bold, the next slide in bold capital letters, because I'm definitely not an expert on this, but I do think people treat, you know, information regarding genetics, regarding family heritage, in not only about the crypto Jews, but also in terms of anything, any people, any situation, we have a tendency to overread into these things. So I would say any exploration into such issues should be done. I mean, I wouldn't say not to do it at all, but it should be done with a spirit-filled heart, with our eyes squarely focused upon what's most important, which is the Messiah and our faith in the Messiah, Jesus, and ideally with expert spiritual counseling. So not only a genetic counselor, a genetic counselor is not going to be helpful with the spiritual aspects and the aspects regarding identity and family and faith. So definitely, like, this can be really cool, but also really harmful. So I definitely encourage that. To if anyone who's watching this, or if you know someone who's going to be looking into not only crypto Jewish past, but also, you know, any sort of genetic heritage, it should be done very carefully. You know, because it can be damaging, I think, to some people. And I think from a spiritual and biblical perspective, the best way to ensure that we handle this sort of information well is to meditate on the Bible's words regarding identity. And Paul and Jesus had a lot to say about this. I'm going to quote quite a few passages from the New Testament which show us where we should be putting our identity, where we should be putting our focus on. So John chapter 1, verse 12 is Jesus' words. He says, "Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his..." it's referring to Jesus, my bad. "Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God." So in the Messiah, we actually become children of God. That's our identity in the Messiah. We should be focusing on that. "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light." That's from 1 Peter 2, verse 9. He's calling us a holy nation, a priesthood. That's our identity in the Messiah, in God, in our faith in God. And also from Colossians 3, verses 1 to 2, "Since then you have been raised with Messiah, set your hearts on things above, where Messiah is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things." Again, emphasizing we should be looking to heaven, looking to the Messiah, looking to our God as our the things we take the most courage from, the most important aspects of identity, not from things in this earth. And genetics is a thing of this earth. And also, Yeshua says this in Matthew chapter 10, on the next slide, "Anyone who loves their father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves their son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Now, of course, the context here is specifically family relationships, but I think this could be just as easily applied to heritage. obviously heritage is sort of extended family, so to speak, in some ways. So I do think this discussion does fall under that umbrella. If you love your heritage more than you love me, you're not worthy of me. So I do think that's very important to remember. Now, also from Galatians, a couple of verses from Galatians, chapter 1, verse 10. This is Paul talking. Am I now trying to win the approval of human beings or of God? Or am I trying to please people? If I was still trying to please people, I would not be a servant of Messiah. So again, he's saying here, if you're trying to please people in terms of, converting or, in terms of sort of towing the line from what they want to happen, he wouldn't be serving God. So we can't serve God and please people at the same time. It's one or the other. And Paul's famous words, which I think we should end on today, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is no male or female, for you are all one in Messiah Yeshua. Again, very, very important. That is the fundamental focus of identity. We all have our distinctives, but fundamentally, above all, we are one in the Messiah. That's the most important thing. So I hope that's what I'm able to get out of this today for everybody. I have left some of the links here. Actually, I've forgotten to add one of the links. I'll add the other link to the bigger study later on. I'll make it available somehow. So thank you, guys. That will end the drush
Eric,
there. Yeah. Oh, it's here.
just
Yep.
yeah, let me show me. I'm here. Just
Yeah, it's all
I want
there.
to mention the community in Colombia. You didn't mention because it's small, other countries. In my experience, the community is like 5,000. It's really, really small community in Colombia. But the good point, and I think in every country now, except Venezuela, the relation between all the lives, the Jewish life in South America and Central America is really good. The government and the economy is really, really good. I mean, Jews can live safe, can have freedom, and as Australia, for example. Just the exception is Venezuela, because the community in my country is very small, just 5,000. We cannot see, it's really weird to see like Orthodox Jewish on the streets, for example, or they don't have like coffee or like a town for Jewish community now because it's really small. But the good thing, and I'll say again, we have a really good relations and they can live very, very well. Now the government in Colombia is right wing. That means good relations with Israel. But even my city, Bogota, we have a left center government, and we have good relations as well. So
Oh,
that
wonderful.
is really good.
Thanks, Jonathan, for sharing that. I mean, I do find it amazing how South America's come a long way, actually much further than Spain or Portugal in terms of accepting Jews into their societies throughout the last 100 years. Like, when you consider that most of these countries had inquisitions, it's pretty amazing how far it's come. So it's really awesome. So thanks for sharing, Jonathan.
Yes, I want to say maybe we are trying to fix that mistake because my country make a lot of rules to let Jews came. So for that reason, for example, Argentina was
Jewish
very, very
immigration.
open. The borders we make really, really hard. So I guess for that reason, the community is very, very small. But now, of course, we have a really good relations. And I read a country in Central America that was a huge community, Jewish community, because the same. Because the same, they opened their borders, but the only thing was a kind of very poor country. So after that, just the Jewish community just went to other countries.
Yeah, that's true. That's
Okay.
true. Thanks, Jonathan.
Okay.
I again, fascinating discussion, but for the sake of time, we'll end it there. Feel free to continue the discussion online, though. It'll be interesting to see your thoughts and maybe some experiences.